You're locked into Transmission Roundhouse. Hello and welcome to Queer Ear. I'm Rory Boyle and you're listening to the Transmission Roundhouse podcast that's queer thinking, straight talking and always spills the LGBT. On Queer Ear, we like to shine a light and sometimes throw a little shade on topics that don't get enough mainstream media attention. But just to give you a quick content warning, this episode does deal with hate crime and violence towards the queer community. If you'd prefer to listen to one of our other episodes, they're all available everywhere you find podcasts.
It was a gruesome discovery at this fence. Late Wednesday afternoon, as the sun was setting, two bicyclists approached, and at first they said it looked like a scarecrow had been tied to the fence. Instead, the lifeless, savagely beaten body of 21-year-old Matthew Shepard, a University of Wyoming freshman, a gay man, barely alive tonight, in a coma, brain damaged, and on life support. Today, two young men, Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney, who whispered an obscenity as he came into court, were charged.
The victim of what many people say was a hate crime in Wyoming this morning has died. 21-year-old Matthew Shepard was found beaten and unconscious last week near the University of Wyoming. Shepard was gay, and while police say robbery was the primary motive for the attack, gay rights groups call it a hate crime. Shepard remained on life support at a Colorado hospital until this morning when he passed away. A hospital spokesman said Shepard's family is grateful for support from around the world.
Like the good, caring son that he was, he was able to remove from them the guilt or stress of having to make that decision. They said that he came into the world premature and he left the world premature. They are most grateful for the time that they had to spend.
I promised Judy Shepard when she saw me in the Oval Office that this day would come, and I'm glad that she and her husband Dennis could join us for this event. After more than a decade of opposition and delay, we've passed inclusive hate crimes legislation to help protect our citizens from violence based on what they look like, who they love, how they pray, or who they are.
So on this episode, we'll be discussing the death of Matthew Shepard, the gay student who, as you heard, was beaten, tortured, and left to die in Wyoming back in October 1998. I'm honored to say that we're also going to be joined a bit later in the episode by Judy Shepard, who is Matthew Shepard's mother, and we'll also be speaking to the Executive Vice President of the Matthew Shepard Foundation, Jason Marsden. We'll go a little bit more into exactly what the foundation does a bit later, but it's fair to say that Judy and Jason have both been fighting tirelessly for equality and greater hate crime prevention legislation for many, many years. The Matthew Shepard Act was signed into law back in October 2009 when Barack Obama was president. You might have recognized his voice in that little clip that we just played. But despite all of their best efforts, hate crime in recent years is on the rise again, and there are many theories as to why this is the case in both the US and the UK. We'll delve into that a lot more in just a bit. But first, I want to go back to something that frankly enraged me when I was researching the trial of Matthew's killers, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson. One of the arguments that was presented in court was the gay panic defense. Now, this defense has gained some notoriety in the past, but it's thanks to the recent Netflix series Trial by Media that it's back in the headlines again. Trial by Media's first episode focused on one of the most infamous uses of the defense. During a taping of The Jenny Jones Show, which is a tabloid-style US talk show, special guest Scott Amajur revealed his secret crush on an acquaintance, Jonathan Schmitz, in front of a live studio audience. 3 days later, Schmitz confronted Amajur and killed him by shooting him in the chest twice. Schmitz's attorneys argued that he was driven to this act of homicide partially due to humiliation. Schmitz was convicted of second-degree murder in 1996 and sentenced to 25 to 50 years in prison. He was released in August 2017. So, how exactly does the gay panic defense work? And why is it still legal and considered to be a valid argument in 40 US states? That's a question that I cannot answer on my own, so I decided to get in touch with Carsten Anderson, who has done extensive research on the subject. He's an assistant professor of criminal justice at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. Carsten provided me with a great analogy in order to explain how this defense is often used in court.
Basically, picture a defense attorney carrying two briefcases. In one briefcase, he has what we call in this country excuse defenses, temporary insanity, diminished capacity, and provocation. In the other briefcase, he has the defense of self-defense. And what gay panic is it's basically four theories of self-defense that defense attorneys will raise on behalf of murder defendants. In the first briefcase, a murder defendant will claim that somebody made a same-sex pass or hit on them, and either they had a burst of temporary insanity or they had diminished capacity. They lost their mind for a minute. And provocation defense, this is that somebody made a same-sex pass or flirted with you and it threatened your manhood. This one is just so strange to me. So you are talking about Matthew Shepard. After Matthew Shepard was brutally tortured and murdered and left for dead, one of the killers, Aaron McKinley, as you know, he made a provocation defense. And he said basically having somebody that was gay or appeared to be gay flirt with you or hit on you, maybe try to kiss you, that is so threatening to your sense of heterosexuality that you lash out and you have to defend yourself from any sort of perception that you may be anything other than 100% heterosexual.
So obviously to me that sounds completely crazy, but I want to hear a little bit more about what's in that second metaphorical briefcase, the area that Carsten specifically focuses on.
The area that I focus on is self-defense. And in America, I think this is going to be the defense that is going to sort of be the hardest to get rid of. They basically say, this man or this transgender woman tried to sexually assault me, and the only thing I could do to defend myself was to kill him. And there are a lot of problems with that. The way that you're supposed to use self-defense in this country is if there was basically no other way to escape either a sexual assault or somebody trying to murder you, you can kill them to protect yourself.
So I'm still struggling to get my head around the fact that this defense can be so freely used in 40 US states. But what about the UK? Guidance given to counsel by the Crown Prosecution Service of England and Wales states, the fact that a victim made sexual advance on the defendant does not, of itself, automatically provide the defendant with the defence of self-defence for the actions that they take. So I wanted to hear quickly from a few of my friends to see if they knew what the gay panic defence was and if they're feeling the same way about it as I am.
So I do know about the gay panic defence, and I think it represents to me a really old school kind of core aspect of homophobia or queerphobia.
It's messed up anyway, but it's also just given another way for people to get out of something. And also it just shows that in those 40 states, if people are in them, that they agree with that, that they understand that you can be in this state of insanity, which is just, it just shows how far we need to go with homophobia, really.
I'm not surprised that it's often used in Texas, as they have a history of not protecting trans people. However, I am surprised it's legal in another 40 states, especially with some of these places being across America, where they have such a large, thriving and progressive LGBTQ plus movement.
As queer people, our bodies and our existence is seen as such a threat to straight society that it deserves to be violently punished. And not only is it seen as a threat, like our existence is seen as innately threatening, our bodies, just the existence of them is seen as innately threatening and we're not even allowed to exist, but it's seen as sneaky and predatory. But it's this thing around queerness is out to get you. Queer people are hiding in cupboards and they're going to jump out and get you, straight people, and you need to watch out because we're here to prey on you. And it's just this complete like nonsense. And also, it is shocking that that defence is used in the way that it's used in the US, but those ideas are prevalent everywhere and are prevalent in the UK. And one place that you would see this would be arguments around the use of toilets for trans people. You saw it in the 80s, the way that gay men in particular were conceived of. And it's just all the same shit. It's the same stuff. I think, frankly, it's complete bullshit.
I definitely agree that we use a lot of the notions perpetuated in the gay panic defence against other groups of LGBTQ people in Britain. And while the defence itself might not have been frequently used in the UK in many years, I think that it's really important to show that it's still having a ripple effect throughout society. So how often is it actually used in a place like Texas?
In Austin, Texas, where I live, and Austin thinks of itself as a pretty liberal city, we had 3 of these gay panic cases over a 3-year period. 2017, 2018, 2019. And those cases really got under my skin. That somebody could say, hey, this person tried to sexually assault me, launch this defense. And there were sort of very mild punishments that were meted out for those cases. One person got 10 years in prison, which means he'll be out in actually less than 5. That individual killed a transgender woman. And in the second case, it was somebody who killed somebody that they alleged tried to make a same-sex pass. That person got 6 months in jail and 10 years probation. And I used to be a researcher in probation. Probation is going to be a cakewalk for that man. The other case that happened last year, 2019, the trial happened last year. This person tortured, murdered, and stole a lot of money in the car of an individual. They got 40 years, I believe, in prison, but they'll be out in 20 on parole for sure, because the person that they killed, he doesn't have that many relatives, and in 20 years, his relatives probably won't be coming to the parole hearing. So I am pretty sure that individual is going to be out. I don't know how it is with you, but when something gets under my skin, I can't let it go. I was complaining about this around my wife about these cases, and my wife said, well, you know, you're a researcher. Why don't you start researching it?
So we're just about to hear a little bit more about Karsten's extensive research. I first became aware of his work when I stumbled upon an article of his on the Conversation website, which focuses on the murder cases he has tracked that have used the gay panic defence. His data reveals a lot of interesting facts, and one of the ones I was most interested in was the fact that victims who live a closeted gay life are especially vulnerable to this defence. So I wanted Karsten to explain that a little bit more to me.
One of the reasons that closeted men are more at risk is that when you live in the closet, you're living a secret and you don't have a community. So if you want to go on a date or you want to meet up with somebody, you are doing that in a secretive way. Nobody knows what you're doing. And so you are sort of out there on your own. And in trying to sort of do that really quickly, they overlook risks to their personal safety. Also, people that are closeted hustlers target them as crime victims. So they may try to rob them or to try to hurt them in some way. And they know that people that are closeted are going to be very reluctant to go to the police and make a police report. So they're going to be able to sort of operate freely.
Can you maybe explain how the defense would go down in varying states. Are there particular states where you think a jury would be more likely to acquit somebody based on this defense?
I think Texas has the most gay panic defenses. That may be because, you know, we have a lot of people. That may be because we're a conservative state. Now, 40 states still allow the gay panic defense. So if you look at my cases, 6 or 8% of the time they're getting acquitted. And that means they walk free. They walk out of court that day, they're free. They don't have to worry about anything else. But the way that it works, it's been much more successful than you'd think at getting a reduced charge. I think that defense attorneys are extremely polished at what they do, and they have a job to do. So I'm not trying to sound judgmental about defense attorneys. They will use a lot of different arguments to sell the gay panic defense. So there's a case I always talk about that happened in Denton, Texas, against a man named Joshua Abbott, and he murdered somebody else, just stabbed the person repeatedly to death. And what his defense attorney did, and you see other defense attorneys that do this, he said, this young man, and usually it's younger people who are killing older people, and rather than saying, you know, this young, fit person killed this older person who's less physically strong, they instead say, this old person who's a pervert preys on young people and tries to corrupt their morals. And then they tried to sexually assault that young person, and that young person defended himself. And then here's where they pivot. They look at the women in the jury and they say, as you know, you don't have to be raped. No means no. And that's what this individual did. You have every right to fight it back against rape. They put the victim on trial. And then by the end of that, I think it either confuses the jury, or in some cases, the jury may be sympathetic and they will result in a reduced charge or an acquittal. I see it as ridiculous. I think there needs to be a lot of training for sort of prosecutors, but the jury and the emotion of the trial in these cases may feel more sympathy towards the murderer than they do towards the person who was murdered. So we had a case in Austin where I talked to a journalist and she interviewed the jury. They felt more sorry for the man who stabbed somebody to death 4 times than they did for the victim or the victim's family.
How far away do you think we are on seeing a nationwide ban? I know it's been proposed before, but to me, it feels like it's a long way off. What do you think?
We have 10 states that have anti-panic legislation. So you cannot launch a gay panic argument, but that only covers temporary insanity, diminished capacity, and provocation. If you can't use those first three, you go down to self-defense. But I think with self-defense, and this research I'm doing touches on this small part of it, and this is just my opinion, but in the United States, specifically in the South, if you have money and resources, white men are basically allowed to kill whoever they want if they argue self-defense. Women who are actually sexually assaulted or who actually faced a risk of sexual assault, I think it's in Alabama, those women get prosecuted for murder. So there's cases where women were actually sexually assaulted, they're about to be sexually assaulted again, and then they kill the person trying to sexually assault them. It's unambiguous. They get prosecuted for murder. White men, they get to kill sort of whoever they want. So I don't think that is going to go away anytime soon. And I'll just say one more thing to complicate it even further. You know, these states that have passed this legislation, I think that is great and that's important. And as a society that sends the message, we don't support this and this is unacceptable to us. But at the same time, that's a political goal. They can check that off and say, hey, we took care of homophobia. We took care of transphobia. We're good. We can move on. But that's not the way it plays out. President Trump, when he said you could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, he could still be president. There's some people in the United States that are allowed to get away with murder and it doesn't follow them.
Oh, completely. And I mean, we see it with Trump time and time again. And whenever I'm talking to anybody in America about a lot of these divisive issues or any sort of political or social issue that seems very, very antiquated to those of us in the UK, Trump's name seems to come up every time. So I think that maybe speaks for itself. But final question to you is, what do you want people to take away from this research that you've done more than anything? What's the message that you want people to leave with?
But I've only been researching this issue for 2 years. I do this research where I look at newspapers and I use search terms and I find these cases. I save all the newspaper articles and I have a file folder for all of the victims. It's extremely time consuming. And here's the way to think about it. For every hour that I do this research, I find one case. So people say to me like, oh, you only found 108 events that killed 116 people. But that's only because I've spent, you know, lots of hours on writing, researching, and then when I look for victims, I haven't even begun yet. These cases just sort of come out of the woodwork. These cases are forgotten. Just think about it. If I do 10,000 hours of research, I'm going to, I think, find 10,000 victims. These cases are much more numerous than you think. So I think I want people to come away and realize that this is a problem and that this defense is ridiculous. And I'm creating this database that people will be able to work with themselves, and that will hopefully provide a resource. It's amazing how easy it is to make these cases disappear. And I think now that newspapers are going away, you can have these terrible crimes that just disappear.
The idea that some of these cases could disappear is really scary to me, and I almost don't want to believe that that could become a reality. Somebody who has made sure that we never forget what happened to her son is Judy Shepherd. She recorded the following public service announcement before the 2016 US presidential election. It highlights the threat that some of what she has fought for is currently under.
I've seen what can happen as the result of hate. My son, Matt, was murdered in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998. He was befriended by two men in a bar who pretended to be gay. They offered him a ride home, and when he was in their car, they robbed him and beat him. They drove Matt out to the prairie and tied him to a split rail fence, then beat him some more and left him for dead. In the aftermath of Matt's death, my family saw the best of America in the love and support we were shown.
Despicable.
So when I see the hate that Donald Trump has brought to his campaign for president, it terrifies me.
I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
He's a Mexican.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't.
Words have an influence. Violence causes pain. Hate can rip us apart. I know what can happen as the result of hate, and Donald Trump should never be our president.
Judy's message is so powerful, and I'm so thankful to say we're just about to hear from Judy herself, as well as Jason Marsden, the Executive Vice President of the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. The foundation runs LGBTQ education and outreach programs to raise awareness of anti-violence. I wanted to ask Jason and Judy about their incredible campaigning and find out who they feel their biggest opposition is when it comes to combating violence and queer hate crime.
In the early 2000s, our biggest opposition was religion, in my opinion, and the conservative right-wing Republicans, much as it is still. George W. Bush was president then. And he had made very clear all along that he would not ever support LGBT issues. He was not going to give them any rights. They were not deemed to be necessary to him. You know, public sentiment wasn't then where it is now. It was hard then for people to realize that. They already knew people who were gay. They just didn't know it. And the reason they didn't know it was because they were afraid. People were afraid to come out because They were demonized. And so that was largely the opposition then. It was ignorance. Ignorance is our enemy.
Here in the UK, I don't know how aware people are of this in America. Obviously, America is a huge country and there's many different people with many different opinions. But Trump is primarily given a very, very negative reception here. It kind of feels like America is going backward again. Do you have that feeling? And if you do, does that scare you a bit? Because obviously you faced a huge battle in making the changes that you have. So it's quite strange to think some of that could be challenged or undone.
We knew when Trump picked Pence as his running mate that we were in trouble because Pence has been virulently anti-gay from the get-go, even when he was in Congress. So we knew we were in trouble then, but I felt like Americans were too smart to vote for him, but I was proven wrong. They were looking for something totally different than Obama, apparently, or they just didn't vote. Everything we accomplished and previous to Trump is now being challenged internationally through the State Department, through job protections, through the federal government agencies, all the things that Obama tried to set in stone just got wiped out. It's all been challenged. The difference now is we are organized. We know who we are. We know what we can do. We're not afraid, even though hate crimes have picked up against all the protected classes in the U.S. There is fear. Certainly there is fear. But as a group, we know what we can do. Again, a large community with a lot of opinions, right? But it's heartbreaking to see. For example, last year, a year before that, there was a survey taken amongst high school students. And for the first time in a decade, their opinion of the gay community was in decline, I feel, simply because of national leadership has now given permission to the haters to reappear. Those kids are picking it up somewhere. They're picking it up off the internet or at home or, you know, somewhere. They're viewing the gay community differently now than they were during the Obama administration. So we are definitely being challenged in how we're going to address this issue. And if he wins again, I don't know where we're going to be. I have no clue what's going to happen after that. But I know it's going to be bad, which is why we're all fighting so hard so that to not happen.
Jason, this is where I want to bring you in, because Judy's obviously just made a few points about where people are potentially getting this negative image of the gay community from, where this rise in hate crime is coming from. Do you see that correlation between Trump and the rise in hate crime? And just give our listeners some examples of how hate crime has gone up in the US since Trump has been elected.
Where to begin? There have been double-digit increases in hate crimes overall reported in the United States and in specific categories. What we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years since Donald Trump first ran for president and then was elected and now serves as president have been continual year over year increases. The political rhetoric of our time, not just from the president, but from mainstream politicians all across the country, the rhetoric around race and immigration status, LGBT identity, all of that has become much sharper, much more bitter, much more hurtful, and people absorb those lessons. And there have been just some absolutely appalling crimes. Oftentimes, most of the time, a hate crime in the United States is something petty. It's vandalism, property destruction, but the share of hate crimes that are violent and even that are homicides or attempted homicides has steadily gone up over those years as well. So it's both happening more often and it's happening more severely when it does happen.
And one thing that I kind of can't get my head around, because it doesn't happen here in the UK, is the gay panic defence, or the trans panic defence in some cases as well, that is now still being applied, you know, so long after the trial of Matthew Shepard's killers. And to me, it just seems like such an extreme legalised, legitimised defence against severe hate crime. Can either of you explain how that is still legal in so many states and why it's still accepted by so many people as a valid argument?
Yeah, I think the quick answer to that is I wish I knew. Honestly, I wish I understood why people who are presumably educated and of good faith would take at face value the premise that I'm so terrified by your identity that I'm justified in committing acts of violence against you. That just flies in the face of all settled law, all understanding of human rights, a race panic defense or a disability panic defense or a Muslim panic defense, right? Those things don't exist because that's absurd on its face. Oh, I felt so threatened by his disability that I'm justified in committing violence. Like, we would just laugh that out of court on the worst day ever. But for some reason, because it involves sexual orientation or gender identity, a lot of legislators who are in conservative states feel like they just can't give an inch and do anything that in any way approaches legitimizing gay people or trans people. If that's the way they feel about our community, they're certainly not going to do us any favors legislatively. And unfortunately, it's going to take acts of legislatures nationwide to make this illegal in the United States.
Sure.
And the right, the religious right, it's so vocal and really nasty when they attack folks who try to move the rights of the gay community forward. They are just relentless in terrorizing legislators who want to move gay rights forward. Even if they're not in the majority, they're by far the loudest and most aggressive. As Jason said, legislators are just there. They do not want to be challenged by them.
Definitely. But, you know, Judy, I think that sometimes they use volume to counteract the fact that they know they're wrong and they're sort of overcompensating for that. That's just my opinion on what I've seen from some of the people that you're mentioning. I want to try and end our conversation on a positive note. I know that a lot of this is overwhelmingly negative, but you've obviously been able to, you know, turn your activism into something so positive and create such great change. How do we continue, regardless of the result of the upcoming election, which obviously none of us know yet, how do we continue to fight against people who are trying to suppress minorities and who don't want to see further hate crime prevention happen?
We just have to remember who we are and what we've accomplished so far. If we retreat back into the closet, so to speak, we're letting them win. I don't want to see that happen. I just am really worried that we're going to give up. Some folks just may not feel that they have the confidence or the job safety to challenge what's going on in over half the states in the U.S. You can still be fired for being gay. So that's definitely going to silence some folks. And it is definitely taxing. And especially when you just feel like you're just spinning your wheels when you get no response from the highest levels of government. We just need to turn that around and just really be conscious of how we can do that by voting, of course.
And if we choose to do that, if millions of us choose to do that, it will simply happen. It will happen free of charge and overnight, the minute we all decide we want it to. And the minute that happens, this will become history.
Thank you both so much for talking to me. Judy, I know you've said in the aftermath of Matt's death, you saw the best side of America from the love and support that you were shown. And I feel like that's what I see from both of you. From, you know, an outsider's point of view, I just think you were hugely inspirational. And thank you both for speaking to me today.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
So I don't know if you could tell there, but I actually got a little bit choked up listening to Judy speak and hearing everything that both she and Jason have fought for and everything Judy and the Shepherd family have been through in general. It just really hit me at the end of our conversation, and I think it's been so important to hear from somebody who has been adversely affected by the gay panic defense, has seen it applied in the trial of her son's killers, and now continues to fight for greater hate crime legislation. Though Matthew Shepherd is no longer with us, his story lives on through the play The Laramie Project, which was also turned into a TV movie. Some of his personal items are now stored in the Smithsonian, and his death was a catalyst in the hate crime prevention legislation coming into effect back in 2009. However, the gay panic defense itself also lives on, and as has been pointed out in this episode, it's not showing any signs of going away in many parts of the US. People like Judy and many other human rights campaigners are continuing to fight for the rights of queer people, and we will of course be keeping our eye on everything that transpires. All that's left for me to say is thank you for getting it in gear, keeping it here, and listening to Queer Ear. You're locked into Transmission Roundup.